about quantum algorithms for the Jones polynomial of a certain particular kind that fit with what's called Kovanoff homology. And I'll explain what Kovanoff homology is as I go along. It's a generalization of the Jones polynomial. Some of you may have seen it before. How many people have seen Kovanoff homology? So this is just to remind us that the talk is about knots. And then I should remind you, just for ground rules, about how much quantum mechanics this talk uses. It uses this much quantum mechanics. That is, I'm using usually a finite dimensional complex vector space. That's the Hilbert space. And physical processes are unitary transformations of the space. And if you have a state and a vector in the space with respect to the basis that one has in mind, which is a measurement basis, then when you measure it, it yields up one of those directions with probability the absolute square of the coefficient. Looks like there's an I missing on that subscript. And of course, one can think, now two examples, just quickly. One example is the well-known Mach-Zehnder interferometer, where you can think of it as physical processes occurring by particles, abstract particles, reflecting from some mirrors. But if you take one of the mirrors and regard it as a quantum process, then it has to be a unitary matrix. And so what happens is a superposition of what goes in. Given an input, you get a certain superposition for the output, and that's described by the matrix. And then the same process, which can be thought of as a bunch of paths that are interfering with one another by the time you get to the end of it, is exactly the same as composing the matrices and looking at what superposition occurs in the end. And that's because when you multiply matrices, you're summing over all the different possible combinations in between. So that's not something we need to dwell on, but it points out the relationship between path summing and, I'm sorry?
Can I ask a question? It looks like you have two inputs.
It looks like I have what?
Or something. So
I have, I'm illustrating the two possible inputs to the half-silvered mirror. H of zero is the superposition of one and zero. And H of 1 is the superposition of 0 and minus 1.
Right, but the Mach-Zehnder parameter looks like. I guess if you will, the particle comes in from the left. Is that the idea?
The particle came in from here, and it got either transmitted or reflected, then reflected. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's a nice illustration of the, at the finite dimensional level, of the relationship between summing over all paths and composing unitary transformations. But as I said, I'm not actually using that except implicitly in these models. Now, this is another example of quantum algorithm, and one that I will use implicitly. And this lets you find the trace elements of a unitary matrix. So this is a unitary matrix, and it's had an extra tensor line added. This is its input phi of some dimension. It's had an extra tensor line added, which is one qubit, which is controlling whether U is operative or not. If a zero is on this line, then U is replaced by the identity, and if a one is on this line, then U is itself. And then you take that Hadamard matrix, which was the half-silvered mirror from the previous slide, you apply it to U, so you get a superposition here. Phi is some element whose, and I'm interested in the phi-phi entry of U. And then you just go through this and see what happens when you measure, and you find that you measure zero on the output with probability 1/2 plus the real part of phi U phi divided by 2. It's an easy computation. And then if you change a phase in here, you can find the imaginary part. And so this constitutes a quantum algorithm for determining the trace of the matrix or a trace entry of the matrix, depending on what you have, a diagonal entry of the matrix, depending on which you want. If you want the trace, you'll have to do this across a set of basis elements and then add up all the results, and you'll have to do it both for the real and the imaginary parts, and of course many times to get the frequency. But that allows one to get at the trace or the diagonal elements of a unitary transformation. And that's useful for particularly for quantum invariants of knots and links, because they're usually in the form of the trace of some matrix, as we'll see. Okay? So that's the quantum algorithm that's in back of things here. Now we're back to knot. Now I need to tell you about some knot theory. So this is one of my favorite puzzles, actually. If you want to jot this down, you can try to figure out whether it's knotted or not. But it looks rather knotted. But why would I give you something that looked knotted and ask you to puzzle over it unless it was unknotted? And it is unknotted. And if you were to, for example, weave it out of a piece of string, you would quickly discover that it was unknotted. But the problem with knot theory in general is that you have something which looks like geometry, but it's really topology. And the question is there a topological process that undoes something like that? And so when you're faced with one directly as a piece of geometry or diagrammatics, then it's not so easy in a static way to tell whether it's knotted or unknotted. But these knot invariants apply themselves to the static form of the knot. They are calculations which are made on the basis of some particular form of the knot. They give you the same answer no matter which topological form of the knot you take. And consequently, if you calculated an invariant and found out that it was showing non-trivial, let's say that this invariant that you're using gives you 1 on the unknotted curve, and it doesn't give you 1, then you know that this thing is knotted. But in general, that is the philosophy of invariants, and it has the side of finding ways to calculate things that are invariant, and the other side is finding pathways by using some kind of geometric exploration to see whether things behave one way or another. The pathways side is interesting in its own right. For example, this one, maybe I show you later or afterwards or not at all, depending on our interests, but this one happens to be sitting in a computer program on my computer, and it can be coated with imaginary electrical charge and asked to self-repel. And then you'll see it unknot because it tends to push away from itself and tends to unknot if it's unknotted under those physical circumstances. But that's an entirely different side than calculating invariants, and we're going to talk about calculating invariants. So for calculating invariants, it's best to have the most rarefied version of things where the knots are replaced by the minimal thing that will hold their topological properties, and those are these graphical diagrams, or curves in space without any extra structure, just infinitely thin curves in space will do. But the diagrams are actually parts of maps of a circle, if it's a knot, maps of a circle into the plane, and then some indication is being given in the plane as to whether something goes over or under, and so you have implicitly a picture of how it's woven in space. And such things may occur, diagrams like that may occur in actual observations. For example, this is an observation from the 1980s of a DNA molecule that has been coated with proteins so that it's fat enough to be seen well. And in this electron micrograph, you can actually see the curve in the plane of the diagram, and you can see that some parts are going over and other parts are going under. And so you can see the weaving pattern of that DNA. And this was one of the nice discoveries that people were able to make in the 1980s with this technique, that DNA really is not it. Good evidence from pictures like that. Well, the diagrams. So there are three basic moves on the diagrams. One of them is to take a little curl like that and remove it or put it in. Another one is one piece of line goes over another twice locally like that, and then you can pull them apart. And the third move is a triangle replacement move where you see a little triangle here, but this line slid down, puts a new triangle in over there. So you're taking one curve which is underneath the other crossing of the other two or entirely over it and moving it back and forth like that. And Reitemeister proved in the 1920s that if you take graphs that represent knots of this kind, diagrams of this kind, then two knots are equivalent in three-dimensional space if and only if the diagrams can be gotten one from another by a series of these moves, plus ordinary planar homeomorphisms that might straighten out the graphical pictures. So that's about as rarefied a basis for the topology as you can look at. And then if you're trying to find invariants, one thing to do is to try to figure out ways to calculate things from diagrams, like that diagram, that don't change under these moves. And the things you calculate may be algebras, or they may be something as simple as a number, or somewhere in between, like a polynomial. And we're going to be talking about a polynomial type invariant in a moment. So the one that I have in mind to look at is the bracket model for the Jones polynomial, and that the algorithm for that is summarized on this slide. I have a knot with a crossing in it, so these little glyphs mean some larger diagram of a knot or a link which contains exactly that locally, and so this algorithm says that if you have a diagram with a crossing in it somewhere, then you can take the two associated diagrams obtained by removing the crossing and taking those four points on its periphery and reconnecting them in pairs in such a way that you don't get any crossing as a result. And you get two diagrams. If you start with a knot, then these may be links. And when you do that, the formula for computing the invariant is to take a sum of the results of the bracket polynomial for the individual pieces and add them up in the way that the formula indicates on the slide. It's a polynomial in A and A inverse, a Laurent polynomial. And if there's an extra loop, then it multiplies by this other factor. And with those adjustments, you could do an exercise and think about this algorithm and try it with an arbitrary coefficient A on the horizontal smoothing there and a B on the vertical smoothing and some value for the loop, and then try to see what you would need in order for it to be invariant under the second and third Reitemeister moves, and you would find that essentially you need what I've written here. So this is invariant under the second and third Reitemeister moves. And as far as the little twist is concerned, it multiplies by a factor, depending on the sense of the twist, as illustrated below there. So that's the bracket polynomial. And if you multiply that by an appropriate power of that factor minus a cubed, then it can be made invariant under all three Reitemeister moves. And that's the Jones polynomial or the bracket model. What I want to show you is what has to be in some sense, the simplest possible quantum algorithm for this polynomial. At least I don't think you could make one that's simpler. And it works for all A that are on a unit circle in the complex plane. It's not the best quantum algorithm by any means, but it is very simple, and it illustrates the principle, and it also interfaces with the Kovanoff homology. And that was my question that I was pursuing here and still am pursuing. Kovanoff homology is a very interesting generalization of the Jones polynomial, and how would a quantum algorithm for the Jones polynomial interface with the Kovanoff homology? Could we have a quantum algorithm for the Kovanoff homology? That's the question. But we're staying with the Jones polynomial for a moment. So here's what the calculational scheme looks like in all its glory here for the trefoil knot. I'm using A and B rather than A and A inverse, and if you smooth the crossing, if you eliminate the crossing in such a way that the two A's see one another, then I label it with an A. And if you eliminate it in such a way that the two B's see one another, then I label it with a B. So this is the first pair of possibilities in bracket of the trefoil knot. Bracket of the trefoil knot is A times bracket of this link plus B times bracket of this knot, which isn't a knot. It's just a little bit of curling. But I'm following out the formula all the way to the bottom here. So almost all the way to the bottom. I'm following it out here, and I get a smoothing this way and another smoothing that way. And then I'm following it out here, and I get a smoothing here and another smoothing there. And now I'm down to one crossing in each of these diagrams, and each of them splits into two, and altogether I get eight possible configurations, or states of the diagram, as I call them. And these eight states then contribute each one to the polynomial. And if we were doing the polynomial in A and B instead of A and A inverse, then you can read the terms directly off this diagram. The one in the upper left there gives you A cubed times the value of the loop squared. The next one gives you A squared B times the value of the loop, and the next one A squared B times the value of the loop, and so on. So implicit in those states by the time they're out there in front of you is the polynomial that we would calculate. This polynomial would be giving you the value of the loop for the unknotted circle. It would be giving you minus a squared minus a to the minus 2 for the value of the circle. So that's what the calculation looks like if you were to write it all out. And a computer program that calculates this would internally, may write all this out and then collect up the data and give you the polynomial. As long as we're talking about this, I'll point out another feature of it, which will come up in a few minutes when we talk about Kovanoff homology. And that is, here are the eight states again, but I've ordered them from left to right in terms of the number of A smoothings. So the one on the left has a maximal number of A smoothings, and the one on the right has a maximal number of B-type smoothings, and the ones in the middle are mixtures of A and B. But along the vertical here, you have one B smoothing, and then you have two B smoothings, and then you have three. And so you see there, this natural ordering suggests that that you could imagine moving from states with a certain number of B smoothings, in this case one, to states with two, to states with three, and so on. And it may remind you in a kind of an abstract way of a chain complex or a co-chain complex where you move from CI to CI plus 1 to CI plus 2 and so on. And in fact, that's how Kovanoff homology is going to be constructed. Chain complexes are going to be made in relation to the structure of the states in that way.
So the arrows
are just pointers at this stage. They are not. They have no structure other than pointers. So if I wanted to be abstract and say what I meant here other than pointers, I could say, well, I have here a category, and the objects in my category are these funny diagrams, and the arrows are the arrows in the category. And then I'm justified mathematically for not telling you what an arrow means, right?
Okay, so you get, then you just assign them arbitrarily.
Any given arrow is an arrow that corresponds to having taken the diagram in its source and re-smoothed one of the crossings and exactly one of them to make one more B.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
So that's what the arrows mean. The arrows have no internal structure, but they are connecting state with KBs to another state with K plus 1 Bs by re-smoothing one of the A's.
I'm having trouble figuring out the second to third column.
This column to this column?
Well,
let's see. Of course, some of my arrows could be mistaken in some funny way. Let's take a look. This A could be smoothed into a B, and this A could be smoothed into a B. In this case, this A is smoothed into a B, and we land there. in this case, this A is smoothed into a B, and we land hopefully here. Let's see.
I think the one at the bottom.
Let's see. If this.
Because the bottom one only has one error variance in it.
Wait. Where are you here? This one, each of those has two, right? This A smoothed into a B goes here, and this A smoothed into a B goes there.
It's the third column.
Third column.
The middle one has three arrows going into it, and the bottom one has only one arrow. So
I guess I have a bigger problem, which is that I don't see the difference between those two.
Hold on a minute. I mean, of course, I might have made a mistake in drawing my slide, but I should see.
I think
two arrows going into everybody.
Yeah.
That arrow got shifted up a little bit. Some arrow got misplaced here.
I think the one from the top one should go to the bottom one. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you understand the principle of the thing, and for the poor speaker to puzzle out where he misplaced an arrow is not a good thing for you to ask him to do.
I didn't understand your connection with chain complexes.
Not yet. All I'm saying is that there is an abstract idea here about the possibility of constructing a chain complex in some situation. How much do you need in order? Let's talk about it. How much do you need in order to construct a chain complex? Well, you need a collection of modules that are ordered, right? You need to have module number I somehow being mapped to module number I plus one, right? So you need an ordering. So you need, in back of that, you need some structure, perhaps, which you're going to make into modules, which has an ordering. So you need an ordered structure, and then you need. You need to define boundary operators so that the square of the boundary operator is equal to zero. If your boundary operators are made out of pieces like they are geometrically, like you have a simplex and you take the ith face of the simplex is the ith boundary piece, and then you sum, same mod 2, over all the faces of the simplex, then you end up with a boundary operator that has the right property because of the fact that if you take the ith face of a simplex, and then you take the jth face of that, it doesn't matter in what order you did it, right? You could take the ith face of the jth face or the jth face of the ith face, and if you do it, you get the same result, so that everything will cancel when you do boundary twice. So those are more or less the things you're looking for if you're trying to construct a chain complex. So I didn't tell you how this is going to happen.
What the operator was
already,
and I just didn't understand it.
No, I'm saying that we will be constructing a chain complex. And the main pattern of it is that it's going to have pieces of it that correspond to these tiers where you have a number of Bs, right? And then the next number of Bs, and so on. Okay? I'll fix that slide later. So I'm going to reformulate the bracket sum a little bit to make it easier to handle algebraically. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take C of K to be the number of crossings in the link, and I'm going to multiply the bracket by A to the minus C of K, and then I'm going to replace A by minus Q inverse. Now, think about what that would have done to the bracket formula here. If I multiply this by A to the minus the number of crossings, then I could think of that as distributed, and I multiplied it by 1A here, corresponding to this crossing, right? And that will kill this off and replace this by A to the minus 2. So if I change the recursion by this is equal to this plus A to the minus 2 times that, that recursion will perform exactly as though I had multiplied the entire thing by A to the minus number of crossings. And then what we have here is A to the minus 2, and I want the A to the minus 2 to... Oh, well, what the other thing is, the loop value will still be this complicated expression. So if I replaced A to the minus 2 by minus Q inverse, then this will turn into Q plus Q inverse, which is just easier to look at, all right? And that's what I was, what I'm going to do here. So go to the next slide where we have it. There. Okay. So so in the end, this was an inverse A, so this becomes just a positive power. These were inverses, they become positive power plus negative power. There's no minus sign here. The minus sign has floated back here. Up to normalizing it again, it's still got the invariance properties. I just changed variables a little bit. And now there's only one variable in there. And you see that this is useful if I'm imagining that I'm going to count the number of B smoothings, this one being the B smoothing, because I will get powers of Q that correspond to the number of B smoothings from this. So it's just a useful reformulation. And then the value of the loop is Q plus Q inverse. Now, the other thing about this is, let's go back to the picture of the states for a moment. If you ask what one of these states contributes, well, take this one, then it contributes A times B squared times, and then the value of the loop squared, and the value of the loop was this binomial. So then, in general, if you wanted to see what polynomial you got, you would have to apply the binomial theorem to every one of the states, and if it had a large number of loops, there would be quite a big bunch of polynomial coming out from the binomial theorem. You can avoid the binomial theorem by enhancing the states, and we'll do that. So, let me just show you what I mean. There. So, if I enhance the states by allowing a plus one or a minus one on each loop, so now a state, now any given state, like a state with three loops in it, it has eight enhanced enhancements, right? The corresponding to the eight terms in the binomial theorem if you were expanding that binomial. So then the plus one will be evaluated just with Q, and the minus one will be evaluated with Q inverse. And if you then evaluate the state sum just as we did before, but using Qs and Q inverses on each of the plus or minus labeled loops, you will get exactly the same result as you did before, only now each enhanced state produces for you exactly one monomial, a power of Q corresponding to the plus and minus ones, and some product of Qs and Q inverses corresponding to, or some product of minus Qs corresponding to the number of Bs. So you get a sum of monomials as a result. So this is a way of articulating how it works with a sum of monomials. Now I'm introducing notation, which only comes later. This slide probably should have come later, but I'll show it to you now. It turns out to be useful to call the minus 1 x and the plus 1 label 1. All right. There's an algebraic reason for that. But you can forget that until it comes up again. So what would it look like to evaluate an enhanced state? Here's one with ones on the two upper circles and a minus one on the lower circles and three Bs. Each B is contributing a minus Q because, remember, every time you smooth it in a B way, you get a minus Q from that expansion. And the one and the two ones give you Qs, and the minus one gives you Q inverse. So that state contributes Q to the fourth, minus Q to the fourth. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. And so you sum over all of them like that, and you get a sum of monomials for the invariant like that. Where what are J and I? We might as well figure them out as long as we're looking at this. For a given enhanced state, I, the only minus sign that occurs here, is the number of B smoothings, right? Because it was a minus Q, and the others were just Q plus Q inverse. And J is going to be equal to the number of plus signs minus the number of minus signs plus the number of B smoothings, okay? So we know what those are, and we end up with a sum of monomials. Now let's go back and think about quantum algorithm for this thing. You see, once you're looking at it this way, there's an obvious and sort of tautological quantum algorithm, which is the one I'm going to talk about. You could make up your complex vector space with basis the enhanced states. And then I want to get contributions of those monomials, but those monomials could be elements of the unit circle. If Q is an element of the unit circle, then so are these individual monomials. And so I can define C of K to be equal to the Hilbert space whose basis is the set of enhanced states. And I define a unitary transformation on that by letting minus 1 to the I of S, Q to the J of S be the eigenvalue for U, and U is diagonal, in fact. All right? And there's a unitary transformation for you. And if you, since it's diagonal, the value of the bracket is the trace of U. So by using the Hadamard test, we have a quantum algorithm for the Jones polynomial. So, of course, this is not a very efficient quantum algorithm, but it illustrates how close the state sum is to our quantum formulation, if you look at it this way.
So there's another issue, I guess, which is, I mean, that you need the algorithm, which is how to restrict just to the Hilbert space of enhanced states for K.
I'm sorry?
Wait. Yeah, I mean, what you, so if you just write down a Hilbert space that's a bunch of qubits, right, that represent different possible diagrams, some of them will correspond to states that you get resolving K and some of them won't.
How would I put this as a subspace of a tensor product of qubit space? If you want to do that, you have to add extra coding here, making it even more inefficient.
Right.
I agree. But you run into the same problem of the extra coding when you try to articulate an algorithm based on a certain representation of the Braid group with some basis coming from that too. So it's an issue that I'm putting under the rug. But the issue of the extra coding is also interesting from our point of view, Sam and my point of view. This part isn't joint work with Sam, but we do a lot of joint work related to knots and things. And we like the idea of thinking about what a quantum knot might be. And then in order to turn a knot into a quantum state, you have to do a lot of extra coding. You draw the knot on a lattice, or you make some, or you make its Gauss code into some sequence. And then you can put the combinatorics in that way and make each combinatorial object, the knot diagrams, into a quantum state. And then again, you proliferate the amount of coding that's involved. In any case, there's a quantum algorithm for the Jones polynomial, and there's a unitary transformation. And we'll look at this for its logical properties, not for its efficient quantum calculation properties. So another way of putting it is, of course, is this, that if I prepare in psi here the sum over the enhanced states, then if I form psi u psi, and then I get k, because that picks up exactly the sum of those eigenvalues. Okay, so I think we don't need this slide. So I've shown you that quantum algorithm, and now I want to talk about the Kovanoff homology in relation to it. So what Kovanoff did was he showed how the bracket, in the form that we're writing it with the Q, in fact, could be seen to be a kind of Euler characteristic, and we'll see what I mean by a Q Euler characteristic in a moment, of a homology theory that's defined in relation to the diagram, and I also showed you roughly where that homology theory is coming from in the combinatorics. We'll see in more detail in a moment. And so I want to see how that interfaces with this quantum algorithm that we've been looking at. So here's the diagram with the mistake in it again. And here's the idea. If you have a diagram with an A smoothing in it, you can exchange it for a diagram with an A inverse smoothing in it, like that. That's the B. You just re-smooth it. And that will take us from one tier in the previous slide of states to the next vertical tier. But then there are some things to think about. I want to make that into a partial boundary operator, just like the ith face of a simplex is a partial boundary operator for forming the boundary of a simplex. So if you want to start thinking along those lines, then you have to see what you might do. If you had a loop in a state and you do that re-smoothing, you may get two loops, or you may go from two loops to one loop. Those are the basic combinatorial things that can happen. And how would we get a chain complex? Well, the way we're going to get a chain complex is as follows. We're going to associate to each of the loops some module, some basic module, all right? And then we're going to take the tensor product of those modules over the loops in the state. So if you had if you have a state like this, and it's mapping over to this with 3, you see what happened here is that when you re-smooth the A, you got 2. And this is going to be V tensor V, one module V, for each loop. Okay? And this is going to go to V tensor V tensor V. There has to be a map from V to V tensor V in order for that to happen. So when you go from one loop to two loops, you need to go from V to V tensor V. And when you go from two loops to one loop, then you need to go from V tensor V to V. So if we had such a structure, then when you correctly or mistakenly did all the partial boundaries that were available from a given one, you would be getting a mapping from, in this case, you would be getting a mapping from V to V tensor V this way and to V tensor V this way to their direct sum this way. And then the next stage in the chain complex is going to be the direct sum of these modules, V tensor V, V tensor V, V tensor V in this case, V tensor V cubed here. And then if you can make those mappings work right so that boundary composed with boundary is equal to 0, you will have a chain complex. Of course, it's not obvious that this chain complex is going to be the homology of this chain complex is going to be an invariant of the knot. That was what Kovanov discovered really does work. It's even hard to imagine somebody inventing this ab initio. I mean, these are obvious things you could do only after the fact in some way. Yeah.
So in this particular case, all of the diagrams in the same column have the same number of loops. Is that always true?
No. That's just an accident of our small knot. But they all have the same number of Bs.
Sure.
Yeah. Try it. Well, you see, that's where the combinatorics of both the bracket and this homology theory is actually very fierce. Because if you draw a knot diagram for yourself and then start smoothing the crossings and ask, well, for a given smoothing, how many loops did I get? It's just really chaotic. I don't know any systematic way to understand that and how they're interrelated with one another. So now, there's our slide again. So then it turns out that looking at it this way, you can understand what kind of condition you're asking for in order that boundary equals 0. And I think I'll illustrate it on the blackboard. Suppose that you had a situation like this. Okay? And these are both A's, so they could be re-smoothed. Then it's possible to do a partial boundary operator on this one, or a partial boundary operator on this one. And you can do them in either order. And what you want to see is that it didn't matter in what order you did it, because when you do it twice, you will receive both of them. If you say 1 and 2 here, then if you do boundary 2 of boundary 1, you want that should be equal to boundary 1 of boundary 2, because those two terms will both appear after you do boundary twice. And I'm working mod 2 to avoid worrying about signs, and then they will cancel each other, and you'll have boundary squared equals 0. So commuting differentials, if you like, is what you're after in order to have boundary squared equals 0. That, of course, is exactly what happens in Durham cohomology, where there are differentials, and you're asking for that. So in any case, what will this look like? Well, you can draw a geometric picture of this by saying to yourself, well, when I have this and it is going to resmooth to this, then I could think of an intermediate surface that describes the resmoothing, like that. A little cobordism describes the resmoothing. So this cobordism can be thought of as the morphism in the abstract sense that corresponds to the mapping from V to V tensor V. And similarly, if you have two circles going to one, then a bit of cobordism of surface can be thought of as the mapping that corresponds to V tensor V going to V this way. With that in mind, you can then draw a picture in terms of the cobordisms of what the situation is of doing one first and then the other. If we did this one first, then we would end up here. This one comes along, and we have one circle, and then these two circles, when we do two, will multiply and we'll end up here. If we did this one first, then we would multiply, and then there would be this one, which would allow you a co-multiplication like that. Did I make a mistake here? Yeah, of course. Sorry. I had one circle to begin with, which became two. And then
right circle.
And then I'm sorry, I'm needing an eraser. Must be an eraser somewhere. There it is, yeah. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Oh, and then that one, they're the one and two.
Are you with me now? I didn't mean to confuse you by drawing the picture wrong. Here I'm doing one first, which gives me two circles, and then I'm multiplying, I'm combining these two using two, which is still available.
What's your final, are you going to sum up like that? Each smoothing step? If you just don't specify which one you're going to smooth first, but you just...
Well, in this case, I'm doing boundary, in terms of order of composition, I'm doing boundary 1 and then boundary 2. And in this case, I'm doing boundary 2 and then boundary 1.
And so then the full map is the sum?
Now, the full map is the sum of both of them when I do boundary squared, right?
Right.
So if these are the same, then that would be good. Now, you see at the level of the surface cobordisms, the moral in that, well, these are the same topological surfaces in between. So the structure you're looking for is a structure on these modules with a multiplication and a co-multiplication in such a way that it actually acts like a little miniature topological quantum field theory in that domain. It doesn't depend on the cobordisms. The cobordism class gives you the same map. So if the map is described by a cobordism, then if two cobordisms are topologically equivalent to one another, they should give you the same map. This gives you a set of identities on the algebras that, you know, on this algebra structure with a co-multiplication and a multiplication that you need. And then you need some examples. Okay. So Kolmogorov discovered that the following extremely simple example does a job. And there are other examples, but this is the one that we're going to play with. So this is the basis for the module, 1 and x. And x squared is equal to 0. And 1 times x is equal to x is equal to x times 1. 1 is an identity. 1 times 1 is equal to 1. That's the multiplication. And then the co-multiplication is delta of x is x tensor x. And delta of 1 is 1 tensor x plus x tensor 1.
So V is a
Z2 module? I'm
sorry? What kind of module is V?
So this is V is a module over K some field. For example, K is equal to the complex numbers, if you like. Yeah. So it's a two-dimensional module. It has two basic labels, 1 and x. And you can have fun, I leave it to you to fool around with, to turning these things into algebra identities and seeing that all this works. Or you can just try it out on the picture, if you like, with some example. Because suppose this was labeled x, let's say, and this is labeled 1. And then you can follow out what happens to the elements involved. This becomes x tensor x, and this 1 comes down. And then this is multiplying x and 1, and so we end up down here labeled x and x. And if this was labeled x and this is labeled 1, then I multiply and I get x, and then I co-multiply and I get x tensor x, and everything worked out the same. There are more interesting examples of this working. It'll work no matter how you label it, you see? But now you see what the another way to describe what we're going to do. I said that I would associate to a given state like this one the tensor product of the modules and so on. But another way of saying what we're doing is we're saying that is to write to look at it in a basis. And in a basis, it just means that every circle is labeled either with an x or a 1. That's all it means, right? That's the tensor product module. So in other words, the enhanced states correspond to a basis for the chain complex. Okay, and this little algebra tells you how to go about computing the boundary.
So what do you mean a basis for the chain complex?
Well, remember.
I mean, that's the chain complex itself.
Let's take the trefoil knot. I knew it would be better, in some sense, to. Here's the A state.
Do you mean any particular module in the chain complex?
Let me draw a picture and then you'll see what I mean. Here's the top state of this, right? So I'm going to call this C0, all right? Because it doesn't have any B's in it, right? And it's going to map into C1, 1B, right? 0 B's. And these are being all A's. And now I want to know what should I take the boundary of? But this is V tensor V. And what is the basis for V tensor V? Well, 1 tensor 1, 1 tensor X, X tensor 1, and X tensor X. And these are nothing more than, for example, X tensor 1. These are the enhanced states. So each enhanced state is a generator for the chain complex, and the chain complex can be regarded as just linear combinations of enhanced states. And then, of course, if you want to be in CK, then you take linear combinations of enhanced states that have KBs.
I guess I was just confused by your terminology because I tend to think of each of the modules in the chain complex as being
distinct and having a separate basis, but you're kind of stringing them together into one big module and calling that whole thing the chain complex.
Yeah, I can look at this at different levels, right? I can say I have all the states, and they are enhanced, right?
Yeah.
And then I enhance them with X's and 1's, and then I say, aha, then any given enhanced state can be regarded as one of the generators of the chain complex. Then where is it, right?
Yeah.
Then I have to think about grading. Okay. Then it's, oh, it's got KBs, so it's in CK, and it would get mapped, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, it was just that difference between the grading, that was just...
Yeah, okay, so... So you see how this is going to work now. And modulo the exercise of checking that that this really is a miniature TQFT, then the thing will be a chain complex. And his a really remarkable discovery is that this very simple solution to creating a boundary operator actually gives you something whose homology is invariant of the knot, up to you know, figuring out how it changes under randomized moves, because gradings will shift when you do it. That's the Kovanoff homology. And it turns out, just to report on something recent, it turns out that this Kovanoff homology actually detects the unknot.
Really?
Okay? It's been an open problem whether the Jones polynomial itself, whether the bracket state sum, can detect the unknot. Will be trivial only on the unknot. But the Kovanoff homology is trivial only on the unknot. And this was proved recently by Kronheimer and Moravka by giving an interpretation for this theory in terms of instanton, not instanton homology, four-dimensional stuff. So it's more closely related to the physics than it might have looked at the beginning. And that involves interpreting all these cobordisms that you see here in a more geometric context, not just purely combinatorial. So it's not spurious that these cobordisms are happening, that you should think of this in terms of sort of families of surface cobordisms. It's not spurious at all.
So previously there was no algorithm for detecting the unknot at all? Or?
No, there are actually a lot of algorithms for detecting the unknot by now. Yeah, there's another invariant, which is a categorified link invariant that, in fact, detects the genus of a knot, the Oswald-Szabo knot homology. And then prior to that, there's actually a way to detect the unknot just using diagrammatic moves, but not the usual Reitemeister moves. You have to fix yourself into more rectilinear diagrams and work with them, and then there are these moves that Dienikoff studied, and his work gives algorithms to detect the unknot. And then, but those are quite interesting, direct kind of algorithms. So more, if you go farther back in time, then the Hocken-Hemion work can be used to detect the unknot. And it uses a lot, the algorithms are getting more complicated as you go farther back in time. Okay, so. Yeah. Okay. So Kovanoff categorifies Jones, and Oswald-Szabo categorifies Alexander. So Alexander was always good at finding the genus of some knots, like alternating knots. The genus is the least genus of a surface whose boundary is the knot, orientable surface whose boundary is the knot. And then this thing here can detect the genus of an arbitrary knot.
Mm-hmm. And when you say it's a module, like which algebra you assume that X on it?
It's a field.
Just K.
Yeah, it's just a question of what coefficients you want to use. It could be C or Z mod 2Z if I'm doing mod 2 coefficients.
Yeah.
Okay. So I hope that gives you a little picture of it. And then I wanted to make the picture a little sharper, and then I think we have to quit. Let's see. Yes, so I want to go back to the relationship with the polynomial. So remember, I of S is equal to the number of B smoothings in the state, and lambda of S I didn't define yet, but that's the number of plus one loops minus the number of minus one loops, so that the J here is the number of B smoothings plus that sum. So that's what we said before. But then you could rewrite this formally in the following way. You would say, well, I'll sum over all I and J, and then I'll look at the dimension of those enhanced states that have number of B's, and J is equal to that other number. Okay? And this is just a definition of Cij, all right? Cij is those enhanced states with IBs and J, all right, where J is equal to the number of Bs plus the lambda. Okay. And then this begins to look Euler characteristic, doesn't it, right? If this were a piece of a chain complex, then this looks like an alternating sum. And if you could only have, you could dream, oh, I would really like that the boundary operator takes Cij into, well, I goes to I plus 1. If it would only leave J alone, then I would have a nice subcomplex in which the homology was happening. And that also happens, okay? And since we're out of time and these are nice exercises, you know the definition of the boundary operator. You can check that the J doesn't change if you play with the combinatorics of X and 1. You'll see that the J does not change at all. The J count remains the same, but the I goes up when you take the boundary. That's what happens. So now, what does that mean? I hope the next slide had the algebra for that. Yeah. Well, this says what I just said, all right? That in order for you can check that lambda must decrease by 1. Yes, because the J is n plus lambda, right? J is the number of B's plus lambda, and B's goes up by 1, so lambda has to decrease by 1, and that's the exercise that you can do. Lambda is equal to the number of plus signs minus the number of minus signs. And if we, well, let's do one. Suppose you were taking the boundary of, of this. So that means you just multiply, and there's your new boundary, right? And now this is minus. So you see the lambda went down by 1. You had plus 1 minus 1 is 0. And here you have minus 1. So lambda went down by 1. So that's what happens all the time. And in fact, if you were to say to yourself at this stage of the game that I wanted the chain complex and I wanted it this way and I wanted the J's to remain fixed and try to figure out the rules, you would reinvent this algebra. Okay? It's interesting to see how it works. So then what's the point? I hope the next slide had it. Yes. Okay, so the point is that we can recollect it like this. Collecting it all for a given J is actually an Euler characteristic, right? Because the J, this is a subcomplex for a fixed J, and this is an Euler characteristic of that subcomplex. Euler characteristic of the complex is the Euler characteristic of its homology. So we end up with the sum over powers of Q times the Euler characteristic of the homologies of these subcomplexes. It's the subcomplexes that actually carry the homology. It isn't just one big homology. It's a bunch of little homologies, each one of which corresponds to a given J. The J is an extra grading that comes out of the situation. And as you see, those are the coefficients of the bracket. Okay? So that's the picture of the Kovanoff. That's the picture of the Kovanoff homology that emerges. It's a graded Euler characteristic. And by graded or Q-graded Euler characteristic, I actually just mean a sum of actual Euler characteristics multiplied by powers of Q. Okay? So that's a rough sketch of how the Kovanoff homology looks. questions before I...
X is square equals zero. How do I see that the degree decreased by one?
Now, for example, consider that. You want, why did I take X squared equals to zero from the point of view of what I just said?
Yeah, well
the boundary of that is zero. So I don't have to count the J anymore for that one because it's zero. But if I did try to count it, what could I do? You see, look at it this way. Suppose I was trying to invent the boundary operator, and these are both labeled X, and this is supposed to go by boundary into a single circle, and what do I label it with? Well, X and X are both, this is down at minus 2, and I can't make it any lower than that, right, the lambda. So I can't decrease the lambda, and so therefore I solve my problem by calling it 0. That's what I mean by you could invent this whole structure by asking that the J remain constant.
And the motivation for defining these things this way is so that that works?
I do not think that Kovanov originally invented it by looking for J equal to constant. I think he discovered that J would be constant if he got the TQFT picture to work right. But then Oleg Viro later wrote a paper in which he basically makes the opposite observation about the enhanced states. Okay, the one I'm making here. So it just shows you that the whole thing fits together and in a very tight way at the bottom. So that's the picture of this, and now let's go back to our quantum situation. Oh, I'm just illustrating here things I did on the blackboard. Okay, so we're back to this, and we're back to that. And now, remember the boundary goes from Cij to Ci plus 1j, and U does this. If j is fixed, then you see that the only difference between taking boundary and applying U and leaving and doing it the other way around is one sign, so that U boundary is equal to minus boundary U, okay, for the unitary transformation that we're using. Because the only sign that changes is this one, the number of B's, and that goes up by one when I take the boundary of this. So U boundary plus boundary U is equal to zero, which means that the transformation that we chose actually acts on the homology. And so that's nice. That shows you that that this situation really is compatible with the quantum computing model that I'm thinking about. I've repeated myself here. But since U is acting on the homology, and this it's reflected in the fact that that we're looking at these Euler characteristics here as the coefficients in the amplitude. And then let's try to just talk about it from the point of view of the eigenspaces. I'd like to generalize this, but I'm just describing it at the moment. You see, the zeroth part of the chain complex is the sum over lambdas of C0 lambda, where C0 lambda is one of those eigenvalues, right? Minus a q to the j, right? In that case, minus 1 to the 0, q to the j. So the lambdas are the q to the j's, and the zeroth part of the chain complex is a direct sum of the different eigenspaces. And then as you do the boundaries, then the eigenvalues are alternating in sign. You go from from this space to the next eigenspace, and it flips to the negative eigenvalue, then back to the positive one, and so on. And that's the subchain complex corresponding to a J. And then the chain complex itself is a sum of these, and the amplitude is a sum of eigenvalues multiplied by the Euler characteristics of the homology of those chain complexes. So that's our description of the amplitude that we calculated. And from this point of view, the Jones polynomial itself has disappeared as the repository of the eigenvalues of the U. So I would like, if I could, to start with a situation like this, with a unitary transformation and a chain complex that behaves this way, and think about it. But I don't know a fundamental way to build the Kovanoff homology that is starting from this. In fact, what I've done is I've hidden most of its structure, which we were talking about, the diagrams and the underlying combinatorics and all, in the set of states. But nevertheless, it does acquire this very nice looking picture at this level. And that shows how it is how this way of looking at it is interfacing with the quantum picture that I've drawn. So I think it raises some questions, and some of them aren't specific enough yet to see whether there are other models that would fit this picture. So this is what I just said, that we've reinterpreted the bracket as a quantum amplitude. The space of the chain complex is naturally interpreted as the chain space for the Kovanoff homology. So they are coincident, right? The Hilbert space of the model is the chain complex for the Kovanoff homology, where I'm not thinking about where the grading is, but then the grading comes in depending on what you're counting, eigenvalues or numbers of Bs. From the point of view of the space itself, the way it breaks up corresponds to the eigenvalues of U. And that's why I'm emphasizing that, because you wouldn't think of counting the number of B states if you're looking at some vector space. But looking at the eigenspaces of a unitary transformation on it is quite natural. So something natural is going on here, but where it goes after this, I'm not quite sure. And this slide is just saying what I just said. And I'll stop.
Any questions?
So then it's an open problem to make this an efficient algorithm, or?
Well,
I mean,
well, there already are other algorithms that are more efficient. They go along the following lines. Instead of going directly into the states of the polynomial, one finds a grade group representation that's good in some way.
Right.
And then it turns out, again, that the trace of certain matrices associated with that grade group representation is what you need to compute.
But that's specifically for the Jones polynomial.
Well, also for other quantum invariants, people have done similar things.
Right, but this, you said, is more general. So I guess I must have missed something, because...
Well, no, I didn't say it was more general. But what I did was I wanted to follow a line that would let me compare the quantum algorithm, the situation, with the Kovanoff homology, if I could.
I see.
And then I was pleased to see that in the case of the bracket model for the Jones polynomial, there was a natural unitary transformation on the chain space of Kovanoff homology itself. So that then the Kovanoff homology and the quantum model fit together just nicely, right?
I see.
Here's the chain space. Here's this unitary transformation. The eigenspaces correspond to the breakup. I can almost forget the Jones polynomial sitting in the background.
Right.
So it looks like it has the feel of something that ought to be more general. But then in order to generalize it and keep the topology going and all, it's not obvious what you would do. Maybe you want to throw something away and make it more general.
Let me just clarify then. The Kovanoff homology itself is the thing that is able to distinguish the unknown, for example, which the Jones polynomial no one
knows. Right, right. So you have the following situation. The bracket is equal to the sum on J of Q to the J, Euler characteristic of a certain homology of C dot J, right, associated with K. So this homology is more powerful than this. This is a pale image of the homology.
Right.
And it turns out calculates is the bracket, not the homology itself.
Yeah, that's, I guess, what I'm asking.
Right, so the amplitude I compute is this. I don't compute Kolmogorov homology here. That's another question. To quantum compute the Kolmogorov homology.
That's, right. That, yeah, okay,
that's,
right.
That's a related question that's worth thinking about.
Right.
That's a direction this should go.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see.
And then there's another, there are some other thoughts that go off in another elementary physics direction. If you think about this model and change its parameters, then it corresponds to the Potts model for certain situations. And then you're saying, oh, well, in that case, it looks like the partition function for the Potts model is being expressed in terms of this homology associated with the states of the model, right? And what's going on there? Then I did a separate thing, calculation of the relationship with the Potts model, and you find that you get that nice correspondence with Euler characteristics of homology at certain points in the model where it has imaginary temperature. So then you're tempted to turn it, you're tempted to Wick rotate it and look at a quantum model, and then you're over in what I was talking about today, more or less. If you stay with the Potts model, there are other questions to ask. How does that nice, something nice happening at imaginary temperature, how is that going to relate to what happens at real temperature? And there may be some story about the analytic continuation, but I don't know yet. The reason for thinking about Potts model is a different heuristic, which I think is an interesting one, and I should say it just in case you have some reaction, because I'm looking for a reaction from physicists. The loops, when you do the Potts model, the loops correspond to the boundaries of regions of constant spin in the model. That's what they are. So when you're looking at a statistical mechanics model, then these loops, what happens is that you have constant spin here, constant spin here, constant spin there, another spin there. And when you so it seems quite natural to wonder what will happen if I have this a kind of arrangement of constant spin versus this sort of arrangement of constant spin, where now these are supposed to be the same spin, these are still possibly different. The loops are breaking up the states into these different regions of constant spin, and then when you go through a saddle point, when you go through a resmoothing, you get another pattern of constant spin. And then the homology theory is saying something about how those different patternings of the regions of constant spin are related to one another. But does it say something interesting physically? Or maybe there's another homology theory for those states that would be relevant, more relevant to understanding something about the actual states of the statistical mechanics system. So as far as I can tell, nobody in statistical mechanics tried to, in the past, write down a homology theory that would describe the way the different states in the statistical mechanics system are related to one another. But there might be something there. It's an accident of history in this case that topologists realized that would be significant for their point of view.
Computing a homology, like what does it mean to actually compute a homology? So now you have the
it means
with respect to
to compute kernels modulo images, of course, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, presumably you want to compute maybe like the dimension of each of those.
I'm sorry.
If you want to know,
you want to compute maybe the dimension.
Yeah, you can compute ranks, right? You want to know. I mean, the homology is the kernel of boundary modulo the image of boundary, but you may do this. I mean, the first thing you may want to do is to just find the ranks of these groups, right?
I mean, you could also imagine outputting like a span, yeah, basis for each, not putting a quantum state, which was a projector, onto the kernel would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks.